Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're taking on something pretty intense. We're looking at the real story behind some of America's biggest horror movie myths.
Yeah, it's fascinating and kind of chilling how reality gets twisted, isn't it? We're going straight to the source material.
Exactly. Forget the chainsaw, forget the movie monsters for a second. We're going to Plainfield, Wisconsin, 1957, a small town, isolated, often snowed in. And the core idea, the thing that jumps out from the sources, is that the real figure behind all this, well, he wasn't some monster. He was a quiet local guy, Ed Gunn, a farmer, a handyman.
Right. Known in the community. Seemed, on the surface at least, just sort of tragic and alone.
So the big question for this deep dive is, how does that, how does quiet grief in a place like Plainfield turn into this huge, screaming, hyper-violent legend that honestly terrified a generation?
And that's our mission, really. We've got this timeline, the sources focusing on Gunn, what happened, and then the cultural fallout afterwards. But we need to be clear, like, right up front, this isn't about dwelling on the gore. It's a deep dive into obsession, into isolation. How grief, when it's trapped like that, can... can curdle into something monstrous.
We're treating the horror almost as a metaphor, right?
Precisely. We want to understand the difference between the sources describe this guy trying to, like, rebuild something he lost and the monster that culture kind of needed him to be.
Okay, let's do it. Let's unpack this. Where do we start? The man himself, before everything changed.
Yeah, let's start there. With the man everyone in Plainfield thought they knew.
Okay, so to really get this, you have to picture Plainfield back then. Pretty isolated, right?
Yeah.
And Ed Gein, he was just sort of there, part of the scenery.
Mm-hmm. Just a background figure.
People knew him as a handyman. You know, he'd fix your fence, do odd jobs. Quiet guy, kept to himself mostly.
And that's the key description that comes up again and again in the sources. Quiet, shy, maybe a bit odd, but harmless.
Harmless. That word hangs heavy now, doesn't it?
Right.
Because that perception, that dismissal, kind of allowed whatever was happening inside him to just grow. Unchecked.
Absolutely. And the sources are really clear that this wasn't just shyness as a personality trait. It was more a product of his upbringing. His whole world revolved around his mother, Augusta.
Right. She looms large in this story.
Hugely. Extremely devout, very controlling, dominant. She basically taught him to fear the world, especially women, outside their farm. His whole identity was tied up with her.
So he's defined almost entirely by his relationship with her.
Completely. His social skills were, well, they were basically non-existent because of it. And the community, by just calling him shy, they sort of, they almost validated that isolation, didn't they? They didn't pry.
Yeah, they just let him be the quiet guy on the edge of town. Which leads to that question the sources seem to raise. What need does that fulfill for a community? Mm-hmm. To just label someone harmless or shy and kind of look away from anything unsettling?
It's a defense mechanism, maybe. A way to keep the town's image of itself clean. Like, we don't have real darkness here, just eccentricity.
It's like a collective agreement not to look too closely. He wasn't causing trouble, not outwardly anyway, so best leave it alone. Until it wasn't possible to ignore anymore.
And the trigger for that, the real catalyst, was inevitably Augusta's death. She was his anchor, the only structure in his very fragile reality.
Her death must have just pulled the rug out from under him completely.
The sources suggest it wasn't just grief, it was a total collapse. Imagine the silence in that farmhouse. Her voice, her presence had filled it completely, and then nothing.
Just emptiness, and his reaction was immediate and strange.
Yes, immediate and deeply strange. His first impulse wasn't just mourning, it was preservation. Stasis. He sealed off her room.
Sealed it, like physically.
Boarded up the windows, locked the door, nothing in, nothing out, like creating a tomb within the house itself, a shrine.
Wow. So while the rest of the house just falls apart around it.
Yeah, exactly. The roof leaks, things rot, it gets cold and damp. But her room, preserved, untouched, a perfect fixed point in the middle of decay, a monument to her control, even in death.
Okay, so that image... sealing the room, boarding the windows. It makes you think, doesn't it? Is that action protecting her memory? Or is it trapping him? Keeping him stuck in that moment, in that house, with her?
It's a potent image of arrested development, isn't it? He's physically manifesting his inability to move on. And his attempts to connect with her after that, they show just how far gone he was starting to get.
The sources mention rituals.
Yeah, nightly rituals. Which sounds simple, but are incredibly revealing about his isolation and, frankly, his delusion.
Okay.
The most haunting detail, I think, is that he would talk to her empty chair. every night.
It'll talk to the chair.
As if she were still sitting there.
Okay.
That chair became the stand-in, the focus for his ongoing relationship with his dead mother, his only confidant in a way.
Wow. Picture that. A dark, decaying farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere, snow piling up outside. And inside, this man talking to an empty chair. The only witness is the chair itself. It's just profound loneliness.
Utter isolation, Midwestern winter, silence, just him and the echo of his mother.
So is that just madness, pure delusion, or is it something else? Could it be like an extreme symptom of grief pushed over the edge by that total crushing isolation?
That's the unsettling question, isn't it? The sources seem to lean towards the latter, not excusing it, obviously, but understanding it as what happens when grief has absolutely no guardrails, no social net, no reality checks. The line between mourning and madness just dissolved in that house.
Okay, so fast forward to the winter of 57. The isolation gets deeper, the snow falls, and then the fear starts, real fear.
Mm-hmm. The quiet unease begins to break through.
People start disappearing. Not strangers, right? Local women. Mm. The sources mention a tavern owner first.
Yes, Mary Hogan, the tavern owner, and then later Bernice Warden, who ran the hardware store. These were known figures, pillars of the community, really.
So in a tiny town like Plainfield, that must have sent shockwaves. You can't just absorb disappearances like that. Whispers must have started immediately.
Oh, absolutely. It shattered the routine, the sense of safety. And even though it was only two disappearances, it was enough. Enough to trigger a serious investigation. And where do the police look when something unthinkable happens?
To the margins. To the person everyone kind of knew was different.
Exactly. To the recluse. The quiet man in the decaying farmhouse they'd all mostly ignored. Ed Gein.
It makes you think about that shift, you know. In a small town, how fast does shy become suspect when things go really wrong?
Almost instantly, it seems. When the foundation cracks, people look for the outlier, the one who doesn't fit the mold.
So the police investigation leads them to his farm. And the descriptions of that raid, they feel almost staged for a movie, even though it was horrifyingly real.
Yeah, the imagery is stark. Snowstorm raging outside, officers forcing their way in.
That blast of cold air hitting them as they enter the house. The decay, the rust, the rot. You can almost smell it reading the accounts.
And it was immediately obvious that it wasn't just neglect. It wasn't just a messy house. It was something else, something profoundly wrong, frozen, twisted.
And the horror wasn't just chaos, was it? It was the the objects they found, the attempt at order within the horror.
Right. That's the truly disturbing psychological layer. It wasn't just refuse. It was domesticity.
Yeah.
Horribly, violently repurposed.
You mean the things like the chairs, the lampshades.
Exactly. The sources mentioned chairs upholstered with human skin, lampshades made from faces, skulls used as bowls, even a torso dressed like a mannequin in women's clothes.
Oh, God.
If you try to look past the initial overwhelming shock, what does making those kinds of objects, lamps, chairs, bowls, tell us?
It's like he's trying to furnish his world, to make it normal, functional, even using these materials, to integrate the horror into some kind of routine.
It speaks to that desperate need to normalize, doesn't it? To create a semblance of a functioning home, even if it's built from the absolute unthinkable, like proving he still had control, that his domestic world hadn't completely collapsed.
The scene itself must have been just mind-numbing for those officers walking through those rooms.
Completely overwhelming. And the sources pick up on these small, chilling details, the quiet horror.
Like the meat hook?
Yeah. Just a common farm tool, right? Something you'd see anywhere in rural Wisconsin. Rusted, not shiny or new.
And it was just swinging, gently. Yeah. Swing slightly in the cold draft as the officers moved through. It became this silent focal point of accusation. A mundane object suddenly embodying the absolute terror of the place.
That simple image, it just anchors the whole scene in this really awful, quiet way. Makes the silence heavier.
And as they documented everything, the sheer scale just kept growing. The inventory of remains, of objects, it went beyond anything they could have anticipated.
They couldn't process it all.
No, it became too much. And that led to that one chilling line recorded in the reports, just a whispered realization from one of the deputies.
What was it?
We stopped counting after 12.
Short pause. 12. What? Bodies. Sets of remains. The implication was sets of remains, pieces. The sheer volume made counting individuals almost impossible at that point. It just broke the scale of comprehension.
Longer pause. Let the weight sit.
So, what does that do to you? to the investigators, to the town, when reality just shatters the known limits of horror like that, what happens to sanity, to the idea of good and evil in that moment?
We must just break everything. All the assumptions about your quiet little town, about your neighbors.
Yeah.
Gone. You're facing something you don't even have words for.
Exactly. The visual horror was overwhelming, obviously. But the why behind it? That's where the sources push us into this really complex, tragic territory. Jean's confession, when they finally got it, it wasn't what you might expect.
Not like a typical movie killer confession.
Not at all. There was no boasting, no thrill-seeking, no joy and violence. Mm-hmm. He consistently told investigators he wasn't primarily trying to kill. That wasn't the main goal.
So what was the goal then, if not killing?
Replacement. Filling the void Augusta left, he was trying to recreate her.
Recreate her.
The most concrete manifestation, the thing he was apparently working towards, was what the sources call a woman's suit made from human skin.
The suit. To wear.
Sure. Yes. The implication was he literally wanted to climb inside it, to inhabit her presence, to be her or be with her in the most disturbingly literal way possible.
Okay. That's profoundly disturbing.
Yeah.
But it shifts the motive, doesn't it? If the aim isn't malice, but this desperate, twisted need for closeness. What does that mean? How does loneliness warp things that badly?
It completely erases the line, doesn't it, between love, grief, memory, and destruction, desecration, theft. For him, in his isolated, broken state, that line just wasn't there anymore. It became a perverse kind of creation.
So you have this image, the quiet guy fixing fences for neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and then the same man in that dark, decaying house, meticulously stitching together pieces of people to manufacture his dead mother's presence.
The contrast is jarring. But from his perspective, warped as it wasn't sadism. It was construction. He needed the materials to fill the vacuum Augusta left. The individuals didn't matter. They were just parts for his project, his bizarre, literal resurrection attempt.
The sources explicitly state that was his goal, rebuilding her.
Yes, explicitly, piece by piece, he said, so he could be close to her again, physically close, building a replacement, a proxy. Something permanent that couldn't leave him.
It forces you to grapple with this really awful idea. What does it mean when trying to stop your mother from dying twice? First physically, then in memory, requires you to steal pieces of other people.
His obsession turned memory from something internal into this grotesque material need. He needed the physical components.
But wait, isn't there still a leap? I mean, talking to a chair is one thing. Grave robbing, maybe? That's delusion. But the disappearances... Bernice Worden, Mary Hogan, that's action, that's violence. Where did the sources say he crossed that line from just delusion to active harm?
That's where the isolation becomes so critical again. The sources suggest it wasn't necessarily a sudden snap, but a slide, a deterioration. Once the initial psychological barriers were broken, the grave robbing, the handling of Frezia remains the threshold for further action lowered.
Like it normalized the unthinkable for him.
In his specific isolated context, yes. Perhaps the need for fresher materials, or the specific desire to embody certain characteristics. The logic is lost to us, but the progression seems linked to the deepening obsession and the total lack of any external check on his behavior. The domestic creation itself became the driving force.
So the world sees the evidence and screams, monster. Which, okay, fair enough based on the act.
Of course, the actions were monstrous, but the story underneath, the narrative the sources uncover, it wasn't about a killer being born. It was about what was left of a son after his entire world collapsed and his coping mechanism became this horrifying project fueled by unbearable loneliness.
The core of it is obsession, grief, trying to overcome loss, not just wanting to inflict pain.
Exactly. And that distinction is absolutely crucial because it's the difference between the reality of Ed Gein in 1957 and the legend that Hollywood built later.
Okay, so that's the pivot point then. From the grim reality found in that farmhouse
right.
to how America processed it and frankly changed it.
Yeah, let's look at how this complex, deeply disturbing psychological story got swallowed, simplified, and basically repackaged for mass consumption as something entirely different.
Right, the transformation is kind of staggering when you lay it out.
Yeah.
You have Plainfield, Wisconsin, dark, cold, snow-covered, isolated.
Mm-hmm. Internal psychological horror.
And that gets completely transplanted. It becomes mm-hmm. Texas. Blazing hot, dusty, wide open spaces.
Totally different environment, yeah.
And the tools change too, don't they? You can use knives, maybe needles, things associated with like hunting or crafting, however gruesome.
It's domestic or farm tools, essentially.
And that becomes a roaring chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
An industrial tool of pure, loud aggression. The subtlety, the quiet horror is just gone, replaced by noise and explicit violence.
And most importantly, the motive flips entirely. Gene's complex, desperate grief and his attempt to literally rebuild his mother, that gets wiped.
Wiped clean.
And replaced in films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre with what, simple malice? Cannibalism? Hunting for sport? It becomes pure, externalized evil, easy to understand, easy to fear.
Why do we do that? Why does culture seem to need to simplify something so messy? Why turn that specific internal breakdown into just a generic monster?
Well, maybe because the reality is too uncomfortable. Gene's story forces us to look at things like extreme isolation, mental illness, the impact of upbringing, maybe even community neglect. That's complicated. It doesn't fit neatly into a good versus evil box.
It's easier to have a monster you can just point at and say, that's evil, rather than confront something that feels closer to home.
Yeah.
More possible.
Perhaps an external monster is manageable. A story about profound internal collapse that's harder to process. So let's do that pattern breaker, the contrast. Fact. A deeply isolated, lonely man trying to cope with loss by creating these bizarre domestic objects from human remains, driven by a grotesque but ultimately understandable need for connection, mostly acting alone.
Film. A whole family of cannibalistic maniacs hunting strangers for fun or food, motivated by pure sadism or base urges, using loud, terrifying industrial weapons, pure external threat.
See the difference? It's a total rewrite. And we can actually use some concepts from our secondary source, the Inspector Story Index, to kind of frame the simplification process. It's a pattern.
Okay, how does that apply here?
Well, think about the theme of erasure, like in the Klaus Richter example from the index.
Yeah.
The uncomfortable facts, the mother obsession, the isolation, the specific crafting aspect of Gene's actions, they get deleted, erased, to create a cleaner, simpler legend, the mindless killer.
Makes sense. Get rid of the messy psychological bits.
Exactly. And it's also like arrested time, isn't it? Similar to the real Wendy theme, Guyne, the real person, is frozen in 1957 Plainfield. But his story, his narrative, gets completely rewritten to serve the needs of a different time, a different genre. He becomes a character stripped of his original context.
So the record is stuck, but the life story changes.
Right. And the way it changes, it reminds me of those bait and trap themes like Aladdin or Monopoly in the index. The real story, the complex psychological treasure, understanding extreme grief and isolation, it gets hidden.
Hidden behind what?
Behind the trap of simple, shocking horror. The chainsaw, the gore. That's the bait. It draws you in, but it distracts you from the deeper, more unsettling truths about the human condition that the original story holds.
And by focusing on the Texas Chainsaw guy, we can say, oh, that's them over there. That's not us. We externalize it instead of thinking about how isolation or mental breakdown could happen anywhere, even next door.
Precisely. It lets us off the hook in a way, which leads to the big question about this whole cultural translation process. What do we actually lose when we swap that complicated, awful story of grief and obsession for just straightforward violence?
We lose the insight, right? The chance to maybe understand the warning signs, the conditions that let something like this happen.
We lose the context. We lose the why. The fictional horror obscures the real-world horror of unchecked mental illness and profound isolation. We're entertained, maybe scared, but we don't necessarily learn anything that might prevent future tragedies.
So pulling it back to the core, the deep dive keeps pointing us to the same place, doesn't it? Whatever the movies say, the original story, what one from the sources, it's about a son.
A son who could not let his mother die. Not really. Who couldn't accept her absence.
And his way of keeping her close became this absolute nightmare, born not from hate, but from a love so warped by isolation it became destructive.
Yeah. We have to remember the implication. He wasn't trying to build monsters in general. He was trying, specifically, to build a mother who could never leave him again. That possessive, obsessive grief left to fester alone in that decaying house, that's the real horror of Plainfield.
And if you accept that motive, that desperate, broken need, does it make the things he did more terrifying because they came from something recognizably human, like grief? Or does it just make it more tragic?
That's the uncomfortable place it leaves you, isn't it? It doesn't excuse the actions, not for a second. But understanding the root might force us to see it not just as pure evil, but as a catastrophic failure of the human spirit under unbearable pressure. It's both terrifying and tragic. Hashtag tag outro.
So we follow this thread from that sealed room in Plainfield, Wisconsin, the silence, the decay, through the shocking discovery in 57, and out into the wider world where it became this huge cinematic legend.
Yeah, quite a journey. And the contrast holds right to the end, doesn't it? The quiet, isolated man driven by this internal, desperate need versus the loud, external, fictional killer created for the screen.
And maybe the biggest takeaway is just how powerful and how dangerous that kind of absolute, unchecked isolation can be. How it can warp everything. Yeah. Memory, love, grief, the very boundary between life and death.
It's a chilling reminder, which leads to maybe one final thought for you to consider, something building on these sources.
Okay.
We often think of the most dangerous places in American folklore as, you know, the dark woods, the abandoned asylum, the lonely highway.
Right, the external threats.
But maybe sometimes the most dangerous environment isn't out there. Maybe it's closer. Maybe it's just the decaying silence inside a single, ordinary, isolated American home.
Mm-hmm.
Where grief has nowhere to go.
The snow falls softly past the boarded windows. A chair sits in the dark with breath.